Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Ann Wadler Chance Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Wadler, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrent Studies. The Ann Wadler Chance Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Wilder. And today we have a great guest who's joining us from the other side of the world. Of course, I'm talking about Dr. Malcolm Davis, who is a senior analyst in defense strategy and capabilities at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra, ASPI. So if you've ever heard of ASPI, that's what we're talking about. So Malcolm, thanks for joining us.
Oh, look, it's my pleasure, Adam. Thanks for having me on board.
So we wanted to talk about the Australian perspective on AUKUS, American extended deterrence, the views of China as a potential threat, how American allies in the region might play in a, you know, if there's a conflict over Taiwan. So we had this big set of topics you and I had talked about discussing. So let me kick it off by asking you sort of a broad question in terms of how you think Australian foreign policy as it relates to the United States and to potential threats in the region, how do you see that foreign policy developing and playing out? And, you know, what are its sort of its parameters and those things that will shape it?
Well, look, I think we've always seen the US as, you know, the common phrase being used is our great and powerful friend. And I think that that relationship has steadily evolved over the years. And it's now, you know, especially since the emergence of AUKUS in 2021, it's now becoming far more significant. You know, it's our one sole strategic ally. I think Japan is also getting close to becoming a strategic ally in terms of a formal alliance. We have many friends, but it's the US that is really critical to us. And AUKUS is part of that. Obviously, we fully support extended nuclear deterrence. We're hosting the joint facilities, notably Pine Gap. I think Northwest Cape also continues to perform an important function. We have, over recent years, through AUSMIN dialogues, extended US military access to Australian bases. So we now have B-52s that can operate from RWF Tyndall, just near Katherine in the Northern Territory. We've hosted the B-2A Spirit. And of course, AUKUS is now a key part, where we are going to acquire from the US between 3 to 5 Virginia-class nuclear-powered but conventionally armed submarines, with the intent then to go on to acquire this new boat, the SSN AUKUS, in the 2040s. So Australia is one of the US's most important allies. I think that we're certainly the equivalent of the UK in the Indo-Pacific in terms of being that special partner, that special relationship. And it's only going to grow in importance, no matter which government is in power in terms of the major parties down here. We will always value the US alliance. We will always work with the US on a whole range of issues, and we stand firmly with them. And I think that relationship is vital. It's central to every aspect of our security, and that's just going to continue to be the case.
So for Australia, as you look north, China's much closer to you than it is to us, and it's, you know, it plays a central role in economic trade. How is Australia trying to, you know, it's sort of sitting between the United States and China, and trying to balance and you know, essentially play with both, while ensuring the Australian economy succeeds. How is Australia balancing that sort of dynamic and the challenges that poses?
Well, yeah, we used to sort of be accused of, well, accused is the wrong word, but suggested that we sat on the fence, you know, that we tried to have our cake and eat it by having a really good trading relationship with China and our defense and strategic relationship with the US. I don't think that's so much the case anymore, particularly after, you know, the period we went through with China from about 2015 onwards, where they essentially tried to coerce us with what we call wolf warrior tactics. We have recently engaged more with China. The current Albanese government talks about stabilization. You know, they talk about, you know, working with China on issues where we can, disagreeing where we must, and protecting Australia's critical interests at all times. So, yes, we are talking to the Chinese, but I don't think we're under any sort of starry-eyed illusions now about a future with China, because we recognise that at the most fundamental level, China has strategic ambitions in the region that are inimical to Australia's interests. And obviously here we're talking about Taiwan, we're talking about the South China Sea, we're talking about Chinese influence in the Southwest Pacific and presence. We're talking about Chinese interference in Australian affairs. So we've gone from the period of when we assumed that we could have this beautiful economic future with China of trade and so forth to a much more realist perspective of, yes, we can engage with them, we can trade with them when appropriate, but they're always going to be a strategic competitor. They're always going to be an adversary in a military and strategic sense. So when you look at our defense policy, really, it's all about China. It's all about responding to that major threat. Both the 2020 Defense Strategic Update and its accompanying force structure plan, and more recently, the 2023 Defense Strategic Review, focus very much on China as the challenge and preparing for the possibilities of some sort of crisis with China. The current government you know, doesn't want to really deal with the Taiwan issue, but they will have to at some point, and we'll get onto that, I'm sure. But our defense policy, our stance on extended nuclear deterrence with the United States, AUKUS, all of that is about China. It's not about anything else. And so therefore, we have, I think, this balance that is still there, but it's now a much more realistic, open-eyed balance in the sense that we're no longer under any illusions that somehow China is going to moderate its behavior or become a more responsible power. We recognize what its intentions are, and we fully intend to work alongside the US and Japan and others to deter China from using military force in the region. We work with the US on integrated deterrence as well as extended deterrence. And I think that's where we are at this point.
So you mentioned Pine Gap earlier, and I don't know if you've ever watched, there's a TV, an Australian TV show. I'm a connoisseur of Australian TV.
Terrible show.
I think there were two seasons of it. The best part was when the analysts out at Pine Gap decided that they were going to hack into the you know, the premier of China's cell phone so that they could listen to his conversations and check his email. That was a bit, that was probably the most over the top part. But there's also a TV show, and I don't recall the name, and the underlying plot was that the Chinese had compromised, you know, Australian politicians and with some within the security services. And it was sort of, you know, it was in some respects, there were American shows and it's a different adversary, but you know, the plot was sort of similar. And so I wonder, has there been sort of a change in Australia similar to what has happened in the United States, where let's say 20 years ago, many Americans were optimistic that, you know, there would be a peaceful rise for China, that we could be trading partners, and that this was somehow not really a communist authoritarian regime, and that it would democratize. And then now Americans have very clearly say the biggest threat is China, and we're focused there. And public opinion supports that. Has something similar happened in Australia, or is there different dynamics at play?
Yeah, I think broadly that the same thing has happened. I mean, we've opened our eyes and realized that it was naive and foolish to assume that somehow China would democratize just because it was developing economically. You know, that was certainly the hope back in the sort of the 1990s and the 2000s and the 2010s. And then, of course, we had the nerve to actually deny Huawei the right to the ability to control our critical information infrastructure. We had the nerve to actually ask, well, where did COVID come from? And we actually started to challenge, China on certain aspects of its behavior and policy. And so their retribution against us was swift in form of this wolf warrior diplomacy, where they suddenly slapped all sorts of trade bans and barriers to us trading with them. They tried to undermine our political systems. And that, we went in the deep freeze with China for quite a few years. We're starting to come out of it now, but as I said, I don't think we're under any illusions that this is a full restoration, because we recognize China's ambitions. We recognize that, particularly under Xi Jinping, China is far more aggressive. They're no longer biding their time and hiding their strengths as they were with Deng Xiaoping. Under Xi, it is about the China dream. It is about a rejuvenated China that is, once again, the Middle Kingdom. It's the dominant power in the Indo-Pacific. And part of that process is not only a much more capable People's Liberation Army, but also recapturing what China claims to be its territory in terms of Taiwan, and also in the South China Sea, dominating, controlling the South China Sea as what it sees to be its territorial waters. And I think that, we now recognize that, China does have hegemonic ambitions in the Indo-Pacific that could put our security at risk, that certainly puts American and Japanese security at risk. I think the legitimate question to ask is, if they take Taiwan, where next? Where do they turn next? They've already been harassing Filipino ships in the South China Sea. There's increasing Chinese assertiveness against Japan in the East China Sea with the Senkakus. So I think that we're cognizant of all this now, whereas before we didn't want to look at it. We just wanted the trade. And I think now it's a far more realistic policy vis-a-vis China. But we also have our concerns about the US, I have to say. Is the US going to be there? And we'll get into that, I'm sure. But we recognize that our strategic interests are best served by strengthening the relationship with the United States and trying to manage the relationship with China as best we can, but recognizing the limitations of that arrangement.
Well, you bring up a great point, and so we might as well just go there. And that is the idea of how do Australians view, the Americans are always good when times are good. But the question for any ally of the United States is, well, what will they do when the times aren't so good? And when the bullets start flying, and when there's, loss of life, loss of these, major $3 billion aircraft carriers, things like that. So what is the perception in Canberra and in Australia writ large as to what will the Americans do and what kind of commitment the Americans have?
Well, look, I think that let's get into it. The key thing is Trump. The key thing is, if Trump gets reelected this November and then is sworn in January of next year, what does he do as president then in terms of critical defense relationships? He's already explicitly stated that he's going to pull out of NATO, or at the very least not honor Article 5 of NATO. That should be sending bright, flashing red warning signals around the world in terms of his commitment to allies and partners, not just in Europe, but also in the Indo-Pacific. And I'm sure Japanese and the South Koreans must have their own concerns. We have our own concerns about how we'd manage a relationship with a Trump 2.0 administration. The last Trump administration, we had reasonably good relations with him, I think, because he had people around him that restrained his worst instincts. This time around, I don't think he'll be so restrained. So I think the concern is that you could see Trump come to power and then suddenly everything falls apart. And in that sense, you know, we do have to think about how do we keep AUKUS going? How do we essentially ensure our security if POTUS is not so inclined to protect the Aussies? And that will require a substantial boost in our defence capability, mitigating risk by, I think, strengthening the links in, you know, you have the hub and spoke system. Well, we have to build networks between the spokes to ensure that the hub is strengthened as well. So in other words, we have to burden share to a greater degree. That's the key point. We have to do more to ensure that the US continues to be engaged in the Indo-Pacific region under a Trump 2.0 administration, that they recognize the importance of extended nuclear deterrence, that that has to be kept going and ideally strengthened, that AUKUS is critical. And so therefore we have to make it clear to a Trump 2.0 administration the benefits of continuing with AUKUS. And I think that, you know, if he's in the White House, we have to work with him, but there are challenges ahead. And we recognize that. And so, therefore, I think we're planning for those now.
So it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. So we'll do that now. And you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLAW Deterrent Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back and we're talking to Malcolm Davis, and we've been talking about the view from Australia. Now, one of the big questions that sort of I have is I think back to a specific event in which I was at, you know, I was on the faculty at Air University, the U.S. Air Force's, where we have all of our schools. And I was hosting the chief of staff of the Chilean Air Force. And we got to talking about the Chinese, and, you know, he essentially said, well, you know, the first time you deal with them, the deals are great. And then when they come back for the next round of contracts, they put the screws to you once you're dependent upon trading with them. And so, and at that time they were in the midst of trying to find new places for some of their raw materials. And so in some respects, Australia is a producer of significant raw materials. It exports these to China. And as you've dealt with, you know, this balance of security and trade, has Australia sought to diversify its exports? Has it reduced exports just in general? How has it handled balancing economic relations with security?
I think the period from about 2015 through to about 2022 really demonstrated to us that we can't be completely dependent on China anymore. So we have tried to diversify our trade, our exports and imports with other powers. So we've looked at much more engagement with India, with Japan, South Korea. I think Japan and South Korea in particular are really critical in that regard, and also with you know, Europe and so forth. We obviously now want to try and restore that trade with China, but I think, like you said, we recognize the pitfalls ahead, the traps that they could lay for us. So we're no longer going into this with our, you know, based on sort of starry-eyed assumptions about beautiful trading relationship. I think we're far more hard-edged and cynical about the relationship with China than we used to be. But we are, I think, diversifying the relationship. We're not decoupling per se, but we are certainly diversifying and mitigating risk, recognizing that things like, you know, rare earths, critical minerals and so forth, you know, are an important asset for our country, and we shouldn't just be selling to China. And we should, you know, we shouldn't just be having a trading relationship that focuses almost exclusively on China. There's a lot of other markets out there we should be engaging with, including the United States. And I think that we've become a little bit more sensible and mature in that sense.
One of the things that we've seen a good bit of is, in, you know, Australia's talking to the Japanese more. President Yun in South Korea is really trying to repair the relationship with Japan. And I wonder, do you see, you know, there's a lot of discussion in the United States of, do we need an Asian NATO? And the sort of the consensus here is, it's just not feasible. You know, we can't really do that. You know, the analogy, of course, you know, China is the Soviet Union, you know, then the rest of us would form, you know, this new NATO. What is the Australian take on something akin to this? Is it sort of an idea floating around there, or is that sort of a distinctly American thought?
I don't see an Asian NATO as that likely, because for the same reason that many people are saying is that there's not that collective security dynamic in the Indo-Pacific that there is in Europe. And, you know, indeed, you know, sort of if we have Trump, then Europe may fall apart very quickly. But I think that what's more likely is a cooperative security approach rather than collective security or collective defense approach in the Indo-Pacific. So you will see closer ties between Australia, Japan, South Korea. India is coming along under the quadrilateral security dialogues. Obviously, the United States, some ASEAN countries. I think it's very interesting to see what's happening in the Philippines at the moment with their realization that they can no longer just coast along and assume that everything will be fine. They're starting to get their act together on defense, even to the point of, you know, the Philippines and Vietnam working together on maritime security, which is new. So I do think that there's a trend in the right direction towards cooperative security, but I don't think it will end up in an Asian NATO. I think that, you know, most people who say it won't happen are correct. Even with that overwhelming Chinese threat that's clear, the trend is more towards security cooperation rather than an attack on one is an attack on everyone. There's no Article 5 there for the Indo-Pacific.
So as you think about U.S. extended deterrence and the nuclear dimension of this competition between the U.S. and China, and then the role that Australia is going to play in that, how do you and how do Australians think about nuclear weapons and their role?
Yeah, look, you know, I think we've obviously recognized that nuclear weapons are always going to be here. The notion that somehow we'll end up in a world without nuclear weapons is sheer fantasy. It's never going to happen. So we have to continue to deal with them as best we can and manage that challenge. We understand that China is rapidly building up its own nuclear capacity, its own nuclear weapons capabilities. And that is raising some concerns about, are they moving away from their traditional no first use posture and minimum deterrent posture towards something, you know, maybe more closer to counterforce, and their force development would suggest that might be the case. Are they watching and learning from Russia in terms of how Russia's utilized nuclear threats in Ukraine? And could they apply something similar in a Taiwan Strait scenario to try and coerce states to stay out of a Taiwan Strait scenario? So extended nuclear deterrence remains vital and probably is ever more vital than before. It's only going to get more important rather than less important. So we need to do more to strengthen extended nuclear deterrence in practical sense, but also in terms of policy engagement. We need to have an ongoing policy dialogue at a high level with the United States on extended nuclear deterrence, nuclear strategy, nuclear operations. That's something that we're missing at the moment. We have, you know, yearly or biannual meetings on this, but what is needed is a move, I think, towards some form of nuclear sharing. Now, that does not necessarily imply U.S. nuclear weapons under Australian control. It certainly doesn't imply U.S. nuclear weapons based in Australia. But what it could do is see us working in other aspects that directly support U.S. extended nuclear deterrence beyond what we do already. Yeah, I can think of a few. We should be doing everything we can to strengthen space security, for example, to strengthen deterrence in orbit, to prevent the threat from Chinese and Russian counter-space capabilities. And these have been topical in the last day or so with the news that the Russians are developing some sort of nuclear-powered counter-space capability. So we should be working with the Americans on how we strengthen their nuclear resilience, their early warning capabilities. We should be opening up our bases even more to supporting US nuclear forces. So AUKUS is going to see nuclear-powered submarines from the US, the Royal Navy, and eventually Australia sitting in Australian ports. So let's see what we can do in terms of enhancing that ability to support US Navy ballistic missile submarine operations. Bombers I've already talked about. We should be talking to the Americans about how we host B-21 in the future. I think where we can plug in conventional operations alongside nuclear operations in an extended deterrence scenario as part of integrated deterrence, I think is something we should also be considering. So there's a range of things that we can do under what could be called nuclear sharing, short of Australia getting US nuclear weapons or hosting nuclear weapons on its soil, which I don't think would fly with the Australian people. I can't see us getting our own nuclear weapons. So we have to look at non-nuclear steps that we can take that strengthen resilience and effectiveness of US extended nuclear deterrence as much as possible.
Now it's that time of the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp and Bob pops out, he of course gives all guests three wishes, but they have to be related to the topics we've been discussing. So no world peace or no unlimited wishes. So as Bob grants you your first wish, Malcolm, what is wish number one?
Okay, well, I do think we need to have a plan B in case AUKUS Pillar 1 falls over for whatever reason. Leadership changes at the top in the US, inability of the US submarine industrial capacity to produce the subs that we need. So we need to have a plan B in that regard. I've always been in favor of Australia talking to America about the B-21 as an option to give us that long-range strike. They would have to be non-nuclear, so that the nuclear components would have to be removed. But I do think that the 2023 Defense Strategic Review that was released down here was wrong to essentially dismiss the option of Australia eventually getting the B-21 as a long-range strike capability. And that would, if we had that capability, that would allow us to dramatically enhance our ability to support the US and allies, including through strengthening nuclear sharing. So I would say wish number one for me would be that the government opens its eyes, realizes its error, and says, hey, yes, let's actually talk to the Americans about B-21 at some point in the future.
Okay, that's a good one. I like that one. Okay, so how about wish number two?
Wish number two is that we do more in space. We do more in terms of ensuring Australian space capability, sovereign capability that can directly support US extended deterrence. The previous Morrison-led coalition government was very supportive of space. We made rapid progress. The current government, not so supportive. So we're having to work a bit harder to get them to keep space going. I would certainly like to see an Australian government that recognises the importance of space as an operational domain in its own right and fully supports things like sovereign launch so that we can directly support US deterrence and US forces with an ability to augment and, if necessary, reconstitute lost space capabilities using Australian satellites that are launched from Australian launch sites on Australian launch vehicles. I think we're heading in that direction, but it's a bit uncertain under the current government. So wish number two would be that the current government gets the importance of space and takes appropriate steps.
Okay, good one. How about your final wish?
Final wish, and no, I'm not going to wish for world peace because I think that's an illusion. look, the final one is probably that that we have a U.S. that remains committed to extended nuclear deterrence, that remains committed to building and strengthening the relationship with key allies and partners in both the Indo-Pacific and in Europe, that doesn't turn inwards in some sort of idiotic isolationist, neo-isolationist moment and assumes that everything will be fine if it just walks away from its global responsibilities. And obviously, if that happens, key US allies, Australia, Japan, India, South Korea, all have to work together with the US to reinforce that. It can't just be relying on the US for everything. So no free riding, no basically depending on the Americans completely. Let's all work together as a team, but the America has to be part of that team. They can't just turn away and retreat inside, you know, a neo-isolationist moment. It's not going to work.
Now, before we leave, just for, you know, many American listeners, they oftentimes don't understand the difference between the United States as a nation, you know, a continental nation with 350 million people, you know, an economy of $25 trillion. And so it's hard for them to understand the difference between the U.S. and the difference between, you know, a European nation or Australia. Can you just sort of set a stage, give some context for what Australia is as a nation, its, you know, its size and its capability, so that Americans don't sort of make this fundamental mistake?
Sure. I mean, in terms of physical size, Australia and the continental US are roughly the same in physical dimensions. So to drive from Sydney to Perth is like driving from New York to LA, okay? But the difference there is population. You talked 350 million, I think. Australia's just passed 28 million people, okay? So it's a lot less populated. Most of the population is on the eastern seaboard and the southern region. It's the inland is very few people. It's very sparsely populated. Wildly differing in the flora and fauna, the vegetation sort of thing. So a lot of inland Australia is desert-like conditions or scrub-like conditions. So it's a pretty hostile environment in that sense. You don't want to be out there by yourself. You know, every year you get stories of European tourists who think they're going to ride a bicycle from Darwin down to Adelaide and they find their bodies by the side of the road sort of thing. I think that Australia as a country is like the US in terms of its social makeup. We're a multicultural society. We value diversity. We have a huge variety of different cultures here. You know, gone are the days when Australia was primarily identified as European. These days, you know, people go out for a meal and it's more often than not we'll get Asian food or Indian food or Middle Eastern food. It's a multicultural, diverse society that values diversity and equality across every aspect. And I think in many respects, the US is sort of like that. I think that our politics are probably a little less acrimonious in some respects than the US. So there's not that partisan divide that there is in the US, and that worries me about the US, this partisan divide that seems to have got completely out of control and is now actually undermining the ability of the US to do policy, foreign policy, defense policy, that sort of thing. And you're seeing that now with Ukraine. But as a society, you know, Australia is incredibly lucky. We have a good quality of life here. Most people, I think, are happy. There are problems. We have, you know, like every other country, there are problems. You know, there's racism in terms of in some aspects. Still, there's clearly divisions in wealth, which we need to address. But Australia is often said to be the lucky country because we traditionally haven't in the past had a lot of security threats. That's changing now. But we are, I think, well placed to deal with some of those threats. But we have to maintain our focus on the, on these challenges. We have to have government that, that deals with these challenges. There's a lot of those challenges in front. But I think we'll get on top of them. And, you know, we have a lot in common with our US partners.
All right. Malcolm Davis, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, we're so used to always talking, you know, internally to ourselves as Americans. I thought it would be interesting to have Malcolm, who, you know, ASPE is the largest think tank in Australia, and, you know, they do a great job. And so to get that Australian perspective, and, you know, if you listen to the things Malcolm said, you can see the similarities, the differences, the concerns they have. And so, you know, it's always informative to hear an ally's perspective, and Malcolm did that. So I enjoyed it. Hopefully you did as well.
This has been a production of the Anwar Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthorpe. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NuclearCast.